people walk in. I didn't need to say that today. The only reason we say that is to be taped, but we're not even taped there. So. What? How?
Over there.
Is the microphone?
Microphone's on the floor.
Pick it up, who's taping?
Well, we thought we were gonna get the extra day.
Too bad.
Well, okay, we might as well begin now. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Esther Mann, and this is the last of five sessions that I've had on women in the Old Testament. This is on Esther, from beauty queen to political activist. The book of Esther is one of the five little scrolls that are associated with the Jewish festival, each one of them. In the Hebrew Bible, in Jewish tradition, there are five little scrolls, each of them read in their entirety at a different festival. These are Ruth, which we looked at yesterday, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes, Lamentation, and Esther. And Esther is read in its entirety at a festival called Purim. Purim is a festival that's held in the winter, usually February, March. And the word Purim itself means lots, like when you cast lots, you know, gamble. It's called this, it says in the book of Esther, because Haman, who's the bad guy in this story, cast lots to decide what day the execution of all the Jews will occur, on what day the execution of all the Jews will occur. And he cast these lots, and it comes down to the 13th of Adar, which falls in place in February or March. And so therefore the festival is called Purim, because although he cast these lots for the destruction of the Jews, actually what happened on those days was the preservation of the Jews. And therefore, there is joy, gladness, giving of gifts amongst the Jews, because it's a story of salvation and emerging from a period of possible total annihilation. So that's Purim. Now, when I was in Israel, I happened to be there during the winter, 1981, and I was on a kibbutz, and I participated in the celebration of Purim there. The kibbutz is a rather somber and austere place in many ways. It's a community, it's agricultural community, and generally people didn't drink very much. They were pretty, straight-laced. But on Purim, they had an open bar, and the rule was you were supposed to drink until you could not distinguish a white thread from a black thread. Actually, I didn't try it out. I don't want to get quite that smash, but it was really a Dionysian type of celebration, similar to our Mardi Gras, I'd say. It's that kind of feeling of, you know, just letting loose. And I think almost every culture has that kind of a celebration within its yearly calendar. Now, during the festival, you can imagine if everybody's, you know, at the open bar and so forth, they're reading the book of Esther here. You're not going to read it with folded hands and afterwards say, you know, praise be God, right? No, what happens is they have noisemakers, and when the villain, when Haman enters the scene, people boo, hiss, and so forth. And, you know, when Esther wins the beauty contest, people are
whistle.
Okay, good. So if you would like to enter into this spirit, you might enjoy the story more. It's really a melodrama, and I think if you read it with that spirit, it has a different feeling. Some people, for example, Luther, did not like the Book of Esther because he thought it was nationalistic and it was so violent. And it says 75,000 of the enemies of the Jews were killed throughout the whole Persian Empire. And you know, if you read that in a somber tone, that is appalling, you know. And then even Queen Esther asked for an additional day in the capital of Susa to continue the mop-up operation and 300 additional enemies are killed. If you read that solemnly, you know, this is terrible. They're celebrating the death, you know, of all these people. But if you read it as a melodrama, it's a story of the survival of the people, you know. they went through the final solution and are still existing, flourishing, celebrating year by year their survival in the diaspora, in nations that are not their own. They don't control the politics. Now, what the setting that we have here in the Book of Esther, it's during the Persian period. What has already happened in Israel is the northern kingdom has fallen in 722. So the northern part of the northern kingdom has fallen 722 to the Assyrians. That was during the Assyrian period. Then Judah, the southern kingdom, fell. The first wave was in 597, and it says that Mordecai was taken into exile in 597 with the last king, Jehoiakim. That would actually make him in the story be around 120 years old. So I don't know, you know, if you want to take that as historical truth either, but these people are representing the people who have come over into this area in the Babylonian exile. So 587 actually is usually the date that's given for the beginning of the exile, because this is when the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed. So this is the Babylonian period. Now, in the Bible, you have the rise of one kingdom and its fall, the rise of another kingdom and its fall. And this goes on. We see that today also. So reading the biblical material is very instructional. No great military power lasts forever. So in 539, you have the beginning of the Persian period. Cyrus, the Persian, comes in and wipes out the Babylonians. So you have the beginning of the Persian period here. And this lasted until 333 or so, when Alexander the Great came through conquering all these lands, and that began the Greek period. So that the time that we are, the time which we are examining is during this Persian period, and the king that's mentioned, Ahasuerus, he is considered to be Xerxes the First. Xerxes the First, whose empire actually was the largest, stretching, as the biblical account says, from India to Ethiopia. So huge, huge empire. Xerxes the First, he ruled from 485 to 464 BC. Now, it's interesting that in 539, Cyrus the Persian comes into power. A year later, 538, he makes a decree and says that all the people in captivity can go home now. All you Jewish people who are here, who were brought over by the Babylonians, you can go home now. In fact, the state will even finance the rebuilding of your temple. The Persians had a different idea of how to control their populace. Rather than taking all the cream of the crop, all the educated people, rulers, and so forth, craftsmen, and removing them from the land, settling them in other areas, leaving just the poor to kind of, you know, eke out a living, or actually to grow the crops for to give over to the empire. The poor people would stay and farm the land, and then a lot of what they grew would go directly to the Babylonian armies, so forth. But rather than do this, Cyrus and the Persians had a different policy, and that was to make their client states, to make their vassals happy. So they sent people back. They sponsored the rebuilding of local temples and so forth. And so it was a more benign kind of government. A lot of the Jewish people who had been taken over into Babylonia liked it there, though, because it was really a cultural center. And so if you've lived there for a number of years, you know, 50 years or so, you have a house, you have your business and so forth, it's a good life. So why go back? So a lot stayed. And this is really the beginning of the Jewish diaspora, or the spreading of the Jewish people throughout the world, which we see today. There are Jews in every nation, virtually. So this whole story, because it's set in the time of Xerxes the First, 485 to 464 or so, is a story of people who have chosen to remain in this part of the world and not go back home at all. So it's a story of the Jewish people living in a foreign country, and it describes a bit about their relationship to the government, and also how they can survive in that situation. So I'm going to start by reading, I'm going to read the first two chapters just to kind of give you a taste of it. I don't think, we can't read the whole thing, which is too bad because it's a little long, it's about 10 chapters. If we have time, we'll read about a total of five or so. And if somebody would like to read a portion of this, you'd be welcome. We tried that earlier, but there's a lot of names, so it's kind of difficult. In the days of Ahasuerus, Xerxes, and you see here Ahasuerus, that's Xerxes there. In the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the royal throne in Susa, his capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and servants, the army chiefs of Persia and Media, and the nobles and governors of the provinces being before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa the capital, both great and small, a banquet lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white curtains and blue hangings caught up with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings, and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden goblets, goblets of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to the law. No one was compelled, for the king had given orders to all the officials of his palace to do as every man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the palace which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zether, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served King Ahasuerus as chamberlains, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to behold. But King Vashti refused to come at the king's command, conveyed by the eunuchs. At this, the king was enraged, and his anger burned within him. Okay, so you have... Okay, so now you have a description, his opening description, this great pomp, you know, how wealthy he is and so forth. And we're introduced, interestingly enough, here to Queen Vashti. Beautiful Queen Vashti. It's interesting, you know, we know Xerxes was a historical king. He didn't have a queen named Vashti, he didn't have a queen named Esther. He had a Persian queen named Amestris. Anyway, according to the story, Vashti shows a lot of good sense. The all these drunk men want to oogle her. She says, no. According to the rabbis, actually, you know, they always wondered, okay, what does this mean? The king wanted her to come with her royal crown, so they imagined that she was supposed to come with her crown alone, you know, come in with nothing else on. Do it. Okay, so she refuses. So here's an uppity woman, right? No, I'm not going to come in that situation. She's smart. But now what's going to happen? This great king is being defied by his wife. So, then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Parshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the princes, not only to the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also to all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt upon their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the ladies of Persia and Media, who have heard of the king's behavior, will be telling it to all the king's princes, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go forth from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti is to come no more before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who's better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low. This advice pleased King Ahasuerus and his princes. And the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be lord in his own house and speak according to the language of his people. So
they just won't stop there.
That's just the beginning of the story.
Bring out the wise.
Okay, so what we notice here, first of all, is the king. He's not an evil man necessarily throughout the story. He has no discernment. He has no will of his own. He's always asking for advice. You'll notice that throughout. He asks, well, what do I do now? Vashti wouldn't come. And then the seven guys come, you know, one says, now you need to do this. And he says, oh, yeah, okay, that's good. So he has no ethical center. He has no discernment. He's a fool. He's, you know, he's not necessarily evil, but he bows to whatever anybody says. maybe it's like the Pax that you were talking about in your reading. Anyway, what's interesting to me here is that Queen Vashti refuses to come. So the advice then of one of the eunuchs is, order her not to come. So it's like kind of like ordering the sun to rise, you know, saying, well, I have complete power. And you have to wait till like, what, you know, 6:30, and then you say, rise. You have to do it at the right time, right? So Queen Vashti says, I'm not coming. So Memucan says, well, make an order, say she can't come. So he does that. And then they have to make this ridiculous law that they send out, you know, to all nations and so forth. Women should obey their husbands. It's like, you know, whining. It's not happening, so, but it should. So anyway, this is a setup here. And it's interesting, you have to keep in mind this figure of Vashti for the whole time. She disappears now. But, you know, she's disobedient. She refuses to come. Later in the story, Esther is called upon to go into the presence of the king uninvited. So she goes, and that's forbidden. So it's interesting. The one queen refuses to come, and she's kind of kicked out. But Esther is actually held up as an example for her disobedience in coming before the king when she is not called. So the two women are kind of contrasted in this story. let's see here. Now we come to the beauty contest. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Sounds a little sad about it. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And the king appointed officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their anointments be given them, and let the maiden who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. He always does according to everybody's will. Now, there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem, along with the captives carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The maiden was beautiful and lovely, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter. And when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, And when many maidens were gathered in Susa the capital in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. And the maiden pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with ointments and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen maids from the king's palace, and advanced her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had charged her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Okay, so here we have the beauty contest being set up here. We're looking for a new queen. And we also have a couple of other characters introduced here. One is Mordecai, and the other Esther. Now Mordecai, it's interesting to note, it gives his genealogy, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. This recalls, to the person who's read the Old Testament a lot, recalls the figure of Saul. Remember King Saul? He was the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. So the person who's read the Old Testament a lot is immediately going to think, oh, Saul. That's the same line as Saul. Later when we meet the enemy, Haman, Haman is the son, he's from the line of Agag, the Amalekite. Now anybody who's read the Old Testament a lot is going to know that Agag was the king of this group of people called the Amalekites who hindered the Israelites on their way into Canaan. And Saul was instructed to completely wipe out the Amalekites. Now when Saul went to battle with the Amalekites, he wiped out all of the troops, but he kept a few animals alive, and he also kept King Agag alive. And Samuel, the prophet, came up to him and said, did you do what you were supposed to do? Did you wipe everybody out? And he said, yeah, I did. And then Samuel says, what's that bleating of sheep I hear? And he says, well, I kept a few animals, okay, to sacrifice. And then Agag shows up too, you know, so he hasn't killed the king. So Samuel says, you know, this is not right at all. And this is one of the reasons, the justifications that's given for Saul's being kind of discarded and David being set up as the true and good king. So Samuel then calls Agag into his presence, and Agag goes very happy. He thinks his time of crisis has passed, and Samuel kills him. So if you had a lot of background in the Old Testament, these genealogies would immediately recall to your mind that story of Saul and Agag, and how Saul was supposed to wipe out the Amalekites totally, but he didn't. Okay, and in this story, Haman is killed, all of his sons are killed, and all of those who were potentially going to exterminate the Jews are killed. So, now notice, he's bringing up this girl named Hadassah. That's her Hebrew name. Hadassah means myrtle, the myrtle tree, the myrtle bush. My mother's name is Myrtle. I thought that was kind of weird when I learned that. and I'm Esther. There's a Jewish women's organization called...
Oh,
what's that?
Well, they have a secondhand store.
Secondhand store, and they do charitable acts.
Yeah.
Support hospitals and so forth. The interesting thing about these names is that Mordecai and Esther, these are forms of the names of two Babylonian gods, two of the main gods in Babylonia. They really are like the chief deities. Marduk, who was the deity who created the world after his battle with the great sea monster, the female sea monster, and Ishtar, the goddess of love, the perpetual virgin goddess of love, who had a tremendous amount of lovers, perpetually a virgin, and also always present at the war, side of war. So god of love and war. So it's interesting that they're given these sort of prominent names too in the story here. So we meet them. And Esther is doing just fine in her beauty treatments, the whole year. Her beauty treatments. Talk about a spa. Okay, now here we come to the really interesting part. This reminds you of Arabian Nights, you know, 1001 Nights. Now when the turn came for each maiden to go into King Ahasuerus, After being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the maiden went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she came back to the second harem in custody of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She did not go in to the king again unless the king was delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter, to go in to the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charged the woman, advised. Now Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which was in the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet to all his princes and servants. It was Esther's banquet. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal liberality. So she wins the contest. She goes in and and everybody gets a tax break, right? She apparently is quite a woman. The rabbis speculated what this means. She asked for nothing except what Haggai the eunuch who had charged women advised. They speculated, what does that mean? And the one reply was, she took nothing at all. She just went in, just herself. Yeah. But anyway, so she's chosen. So you have a beautiful, here's the beauty queen. She becomes the beauty queen. And she's so beautiful and she's so obedient. You know, she doesn't tell her race. She does just what Mordecai tells her to do. Perfect woman, right? According to the description that we have in chapter 1. Perfect. She's beautiful and she does what, you know, she does what the men folk want. So here's the beauty queen. Now we're going to leave her for a little bit, and I think I'm going to skip, I'm going to start just telling the story for a few scenes just to move us along a little bit. What happens is that Mordecai is always sitting at the gate, the king's gate. Apparently he has some minor duties. Maybe he's gatekeeper or something like that. We don't really know. But he's always sitting at the gate. And he happens to overhear these two guys here, Bigthan and Teresh. They're two of the king's officials. And these two guys are planning an assassination of the king. So Mordecai gets wind of it, and he tells Esther, and Esther informs the king. And so King Ahasuerus' life is saved. And all this is written down in the chronicles of the king. So everything's written down that this has happened. Then we meet Haman. Haman the Agagite. And we discover that he is elevated. He's elevated. He's second in command now to the king. We don't know what he's done, but he has this remarkable power all of a sudden, and he's very proud of it. He's walking around, and everybody's bowing down to him, and he walks by the place that Mordecai is sitting, and Mordecai does not bow down to him. And that really enrages him. He's getting really angry, and this happens day after day, and finally he asks, you know, who is this guy? And it's made known to him that this guy's a Jew. Now, whether he wouldn't bow down to him because Jews didn't bow down to anything except God, or whether it was that personal animosity between the descendants of Saul and Agag, it doesn't really say, but he was a Jew, yeah, so he wouldn't bow down. Now, this made Haman so angry that he decided to destroy all the Jews. Get rid of the problem here, rebellious people. So he goes up to King Ahasuerus and he says, "There's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among your peoples and all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it's not for the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it in the king's treasuries. So he says, kill this people. They're different. They have different laws. They don't obey your laws. And I'll bribe you. I'll give you. It's something like, it's millions of dollars. I'll put this in your treasury if you do it. And the king says, that sounds like a good idea. He always says that. Oh, good idea. Good idea. So he gets the king's signet ring, which is going to make it official. And remember, no decree of the king can ever be rescinded. So they send out this this information that on a certain date, which is the 13th of Adar, which is this month in the winter, it's a lunar calendar, so that's why it's kind of, you know, February, March. The 13th of Adar is going to be the day for the final solution. All the Jews are going to be wiped out. And Haman had arrived at this by casting lots. Arrived at this date by casting lots. So when this happens, all the Jewish people in all the provinces are just devastated. This is the end, and so they're weeping and so forth. And Mordecai goes to his job dressed in sackcloth with ashes on his head, which is a sign of mourning. And Esther hears about this, and I guess she's embarrassed or something. She tries to send him some better clothes, you know, dress up, you know. But he comes back to her and he says, no, you know, we're all going to be wiped out. We're all going to be exterminated. And he says, you've got to do something about this. You've got to go before the king and plead for your people. And Esther then answers and says, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. And I have not been called to come in to the king for 30 days. So, you know, if I just walk in there, I'm going to be killed. Then, this is probably the central part of the book here, I think. Mordecai tells Esther, through a messenger. This is in 4:13. Then Mordecai told them to return answer to Esther. Think not that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another quarter. But you and your father's house will be. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Okay, so she can't keep her cover anymore. She can't just pass anymore. She'll be exterminated along with the other Jews. It says that even if she does keep quiet, this is her time. You know, she's in this particular place at this particular time. This is her historical moment to act. It's now. Maybe this is why she was even put in this position. And he says, you know, if you don't, help will come from another quarter. It's not all dependent on you. There's implied here that God is in charge of history, no matter if people mess up or not, and the Jews will be somehow saved anyway. It's interesting that the book of Esther never mentions God once. The word God is never mentioned, and no other name of God is ever mentioned. This might have been one of the reasons that the book status as part of the Bible was still contested in the first couple of centuries of the Common Era. We know that from the Mishnah, the Jewish source. There was a question whether or not it defiled the hands. Only certain books with a certain holy quality made the hands unclean when you touched them. And it was debated whether or not Esther had this quality or not. And perhaps that was one of the reasons, because it never mentions God at all. And in fact, the Greek version, the Greek translation, adds a lot of prayers and stuff like that to try to make Esther a little more religious. So if you read the Greek version, it has a lot more prayers and so forth. But some people think that this reference to the other place is a reference to God's acting sort of behind the scenes. And in fact, in the Jewish tradition, Hamakom, the place, is one of the names for God, probably taken from this very chapter. So here she's called to become, to move from being the beauty queen to being a political activist, taking a stand for once. And it's here that she finally takes control and she gives an order. At this point, she tells Mordecai, go organize a fast. for all the Jews. So instead of just being the recipient of Mordecai's advice and being the shy beauty queen, she organizes a fast because she's going to take action finally. So on the third day, Esther puts on her royal robes. I'll read a little bit from 5 here. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace opposite the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne inside the palace opposite to the entrance of the palace. And when the king saw King Esther standing in the court, she found favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even half of my kingdom." So there she is, able to ask anything she wants. She's okay, right? He's not going to do away with her, even though she entered without permission. And instead of spilling all the beans right away, whether this is because of cowardice or whether she's being subtle making sure that her request will be answered, she asks for his attendance at a dinner party the guest will be the king and Haman, and she's going to make dinner. And so he says, okay, fine. So the king and Haman come to this dinner party that Esther's prepared, and the king is having a great time, and he asks her again, "What do you want? I'll give you anything, half my kingdom." And she says, "Would you come to another dinner party?" it's kind of playing a little safe, you know. "Would you come to another dinner party, you and Haman?" So that's arranged. And Haman goes home and he's so happy because he's been having these dinner parties with the very high ups there. And he's walking home feeling great. And of course he sees Mordecai there, and Mordecai doesn't bow to him, and it just ruins his day. So he goes home and he's telling his wife, he's saying, "You would not believe it. I had dinner with the king and queen today, and they invited me again. But there's this guy, Mordecai, that guy, he really rubs me the wrong way. What am I going to do about that?" And his wife Zeresh says, "Look, you are second in command. You can do whatever you want. Kill him." So Haman builds this huge gallows, something like 50 cubits high, and this huge gallows to kill Mordecai on. So he's going to solve that problem, get rid of him even before the day of execution of all the Jews. Now we switch back to the king's palace. And the king couldn't sleep one night. So what do you do when you can't sleep? Often we start reading, fall asleep. So what he had people reading him was the chronicles, everything that had happened in his kingdom. He was going kind of reviewing the history. And they came up to the part where Mordecai had saved his life, had revealed the plot to assassinate him. And the king, Ahasuerus, says, "What did we do for this guy? How did we reward him?" And the people who are reading say, "We didn't do anything for him." No. And the king says, "Oh boy, what an oversight. We've got to do something about that." But he doesn't know exactly what. The king never has any ideas. He never, ever formulates an idea, if you notice in the Book of Esther. It's just whatever people around him say, he does. So he needs an idea. So he says, "Is there anybody over there in the courtyard that we can ask?" And Haman happens to be coming in. So Haman comes in, and the king... Very good. And then the king asks him, says, "What do you think I ought to do to the person whom I would like to honor?" And Haman, of course, says, "I think that's me." And he says, "Well, if I were you, I would take royal robes that you've already worn, that the king has already worn, and a crown that the king has worn, and I would get a horse that the king has rode and has ridden, and I will place this fellow that I want to honor on this horse, and I'll have a high official leading the horse, crying, 'This is the king's favorite.'" And so the king says, "Do that to Mordecai, would you?"
No.
So Mordecai is honored in this way, and Haman is so embarrassed he has to lead him through town. So then he goes home and he talks to his wife, Zeresh, again. He says, "I can't believe it. You can't believe it. This guy, Mordecai, was honored in this way." And Zeresh is a little smarter than Haman in some ways. And she says, "Boy, if the kings decide to honor Mordecai this way and he's from the Jewish people, I think you're in trouble." And at that moment, the people come and get Haman and take him to the banquet. So there he's whisked away to the banquet. And there they are.
Right now.
What?
Can't talk anymore right now. Honey.
Right. So there he is with the queen and king, and they're all eating together. And once again, the king is just delighted with this wonderful meal, and he says to Esther, "What can I do for you? Up to half of my kingdom. What is your desire and your request?" And finally she says, "My desire is my life, and my request is my people. If we were just going to be sold into slavery, I wouldn't complain, I wouldn't bother, but we are all going to be annihilated, so I ask you, please spare us." And the king is enraged and says, "Who's going to do this?" And Queen Esther says, "That man right there." The king becomes so enraged, he can't control himself, he goes outside. And there the two are, Esther and Haman, and Haman is pleading, begging for his life, and he goes up to the queen, and in those days they would lie down to eat on couches. So he's on his knees, having his arms supplicating Esther when the king comes back in, and it looks like Haman's attacking the queen. And the king is so enraged, he says, "He's raping my wife right here while we're having dinner." So then somebody says, "Yeah, and not only that, he's built gallows to hang Mordecai, who you've just honored." And so the king says, "Take him to those gallows." Yay. And there he is. He's hung on those high gallows. Yay. So now Haman's gone. He's gotten what he deserves, hung on his own gallows. But the problem still remains because the 13th of Adar is coming up. So Queen Esther says, "Is there no way you can get rid of this order?" And he says, "No, I'm sorry. The order, the law of the king can never be reversed." And so the king, or somebody, comes up with an idea. I think it actually may be the king this time, I'm not sure. But anyway, he says, but what we can do is we can have a different order, and that is, the Jewish people could be allowed to gather and to defend themselves against this on the same day. And so that's exactly what happens. Letters are sent out to all the provinces with the king's seal saying, "Organize yourself on this day, all you Jewish people, and fight your enemies, fight for your lives." And there's joy and celebration. The sorrow and the mourning has turned to joy and celebration. And the big day comes, the 13th of Adar, and it's a day in which the Jewish people are victorious, and they wipe out all threat. Yay! Even 75,000 people wiped out. 500 were wiped out in Susa. And the queen comes up to the king a little later and says, "Do you think we could have an extra day to kind of take care of some of the others that are still left?" And he says, "Oh, sure, sure." So in Susa there were 2 days, and 300 additional people were killed. Now, so here, the Jewish people are saved out of this hopeless kind of situation, and they continue. So Esther and Mordecai, they decide, well, this has got to be commemorated every year. So they send letters all around and say, "We're going to commemorate these days, the 14th and 15th of Adar, the day after the fight. We're going to remember it as a time of great gladness and celebration, and we'll give gifts and so forth. So year after year, this will be recounted." And all of Haman's property is given over to Esther, and she gives it to Mordecai to take charge of it. And Mordecai is raised to second in command where Haman was. So he is sort of the original Henry Kissinger type Jew who's, you know, not president, but just right, you know, doing almost everything else. We also have other figures such as Joseph and Daniel who are similar to Mordecai in this respect. And in a way, it reveals a kind of attitude about how do you live in a foreign land under a foreign government? Do you oppose it? Do you work within it and try to manipulate the sort of mindless power which rules the nation? So everything ends well in this story for the Jewish people. And as I said, some people, Luther, others, haven't liked it because they thought it was sort of nationalistic, violent, and so forth. But if you remember, the story was told by a people with no political power and no military power at all. It's a melodrama celebrating survival in very difficult kinds of situations. One of the things that I really like about the story is that it is a story, when you look at the character of Esther, it's a story of a particular person who finds herself in a particular position at a particular time, and she has to recognize the importance of being right there at that particular moment and to take actions. So she moves from being the perfect, you know, woman, obedient woman, to being the political activist and disobeying, you know, the rule of the land in order to bring about the survival of her people. And then also there's that theme that's implied that God is always behind all of the events of history, even the throwing of lots, so that the date that was to be the date of the annihilation of the Jews, it becomes the day of the celebration of the survival of the Jews. Any comments or questions about the story? Too good a story, huh?
Is that the end of the story? Never find out any more about what happened to Esther.
Well, she just remains queen, and Mordecai remains number two in the land, and they keep on going, and the Jewish people survive. Yeah, that's the end of the story. We don't know what happens after that.
I like her method of these dinner parties and. One of these earlier stories we did this week, she would have seduced this Haman into her tent and driven a tent peg. And identifying and make the decision to hang him from the gals. I like that better. Little subtle.
Yeah, she's clever.
You're civilized.
Civilized. But she keeps her hands clean.
But we didn't know that.
Did you have a comment?
Just a question from your studies. And this book is the apocryphal book about Esther. Is that the Greek version of the prayer?
Yeah.
And how did they ever come into being?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you look at the New Revised Standard Version or the Bible that I have also, it's an Oxford annotated Bible. It's the Revised Standard Version, but it also has the Apocrypha in the back. And if you look at a Catholic Bible, it'll have the apocryphal books in it. Bible was translated into the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, which is the only thing that there was at that time, was translated into Greek beginning around 250 BC or so. And this happened in Egypt. Apparently, the Jewish people that were there no longer spoke Hebrew. So you have this diaspora phenomenon happening, you know, all over the world, and people were not able to understand Hebrew anymore. So there was the beginning of the translation into from Hebrew into Greek of the Bible. So that's how we get the Septuagint, or the Greek version. What happened, it's interesting, some of the books were translated very literally. For example, the first five books of the Bible, they were translated very literally because those were the most central books, the Torah. That was the Torah, the most central set of books for the Jewish faith. And the prophets were translated, I don't know, it's kind of a range, a little looser, but still attention. But then there are some books that are translated very, very loosely, and you can see that from this, you can see that already by that time, 250 or so BC, the first five books were seen as somehow very special set-off normative, you know, don't touch them, translate them literally. and the prophets somewhere in the middle, and there was a whole group of other writings, which in the Hebrew Bible, they're still called the writings, which were important but weren't quite as central, and there was a more loose translation. You know, it was, they were great stories, but they weren't, you know, you didn't have to like slavishly copy them. And in some of these, you have prayers and other things inserted. So when you look at the stuff that's in the Apocrypha in these different versions, you'll see that you have things. For example, when right before Esther went into the king, there's a long prayer about how, oh, it's great. If I have time, I'll find it. But she talks about how she abhors her position of power. She abhors her royal robes and her crown. It's like a menstruous rag to her, but she must wear it. And she just goes into this whole thing, just, oh God, you know, but give me the strength. I'm only a woman, but, you know, and it just like goes on and on. And she's seen as sort of a very pious person. And I think those were added to kind of, for one thing, to make it a more religious book, because really it has nothing, it never mentions God. So I think that's kind of how it came about, sort of a tradition.
That's the only real difference there is in the book, was all her prayers.
Her prayers, right, yeah. And there's also a prayer of Mordecai, and I think there's an additional letter or something of the king, I'm not sure.
Well, I think it's rather religious in another way. I mean, if you think about it, here we're going to end up killing 75,000 people, an extra 300 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting part about it, before any of that happens, mm-hmm. is that basically Haman is killed on his own jealousy
mm-hmm.
and rage.
Mm-hmm.
He does himself in.
Mm-hmm.
And the way she deals with that is to wait. I mean, she didn't actually take arms. She didn't use the king's power to have Haman done in.
Mm-hmm.
He does himself in. And when they make the decree, the Jews don't immediately revolt. In some ways, they're given permission. So it is actually a rather strange message about defense.
Hmm.
Not it's not the kind of warlike, you know, it's not, we're just going to kill our enemies.
Mm-hmm. It's not a war of conquest.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And her waiting and her fasting and so forth have a rather different outcome. I mean, certainly one of the biblical messages probably is that about this question of opposition. Is what is evil going to fall because we knock it down? Or is it going to fall of its own? And our problem is to not give it power.
Hmm. Good point. Yeah, in the book of Proverbs especially, there's this philosophy that if you dig a pit, you're going to fall into it, that kind of thing. And that's true. Haman builds the gallows. He's hanged on the gallows.
Mm-hmm.
There's a plot to exterminate the Jews. Those who plot are exterminated. So there is a way that the book of Esther could be seen as a kind of a wisdom, piece of wisdom literature, because in this wisdom tradition, that theme of you get exactly what you give out
mm-hmm.
is really central. So you have a good point there. And you're right, it's not seen as like the conquest of the Holy Land or anything like that, wiping out people that are already there, but in response to a threat. Uh-huh.
So does King Ahasuerus get off scot-free then?
Oh, scot-free.
And he, basically 75,000 of his people are killed.
Yeah.
And he still remains.
He remains in power.
But it may not have been of his tribe.
What?
It may not have been of his tribe, because his people were all kinds of different
uh-huh.
people, weren't they?
Yeah, there were like 127 provinces or something.
Ethiopia?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it does say that there were 800 total killed in the capital city, though, some of his people. Yeah, he never mentions that. It just, he's just sort of the symbol of unconscious, manipulable power, you know, almost in this story, I think. But yeah, never mentions any uprisings by his people or anything like that. It's just a story, you know, from the Jewish point of view, so you never know what those 75,000.
Naaman had been working at home in America. What?
And all men have been loyal to their home ever after.
Ever after. Yeah, but Esther celebrated and she stood up to the king's command. So.
Do Jews in the United States celebrate Purim that
uh-huh.
way?
Uh-huh. Yeah, why don't you, can you say a few things about
well,
that?
Yeah, they gamble. They have big gambling parties. The kids have to gamble with candy and stuff. Uh-huh. For this, and they do it with a Punch and Judy show, and the kids are really involved, and they do these, and they have usually, it's a puppet, well, the time I saw the screen, it was with a puppet theater, and hugely melodramatic, and the candy brought out his accordion, and they all had a big dance at the end, and it was really wild, yeah. But there's a Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it was, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Esther, how'd you get the name Esther?
My great aunt was named Esther. So it's a family name.
But she was, you say she's not historical, Esther.
Well,
in the sense that.
Anyway, we don't know of any queens named Esther. Mm-hmm. And there is a Persian queen, where she says it's a Persian queen of Mestres. And
yeah.
No record ever, anyway, you know. And the book makes it sound like, okay, she's the central queen, you know, and everything. She won the beauty contest, and so she took Vashti's place. But neither Vashti nor Esther are ever mentioned in the historical records. And it's interesting, you know, we have records from those times, because these were huge empires with great administrative staffs, you know, that recorded things. It's interesting to have that material to compare it with. Will, any other comments or thoughts? Thank you very much for participating in this.